Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Liberty and the Law, the podcast series that examines the critical elements of a strong legal defense in criminal cases. Join respected attorney James Doerr for this lively discussion on the rights of criminal defendants and the important role defense attorneys play in our legal system.
The Illinois Supreme Court is the source of the trial that we're going to discuss today, and I'll admit, when you're drawing materials from the Supreme Court level, you might expect, let's say, meatier content than what we'll discuss today. Now, not that the content of our discussion is going to be lacking, but the charges in the case just wouldn't seem to appear to be too substantial. We'll find out how and why it ended up in the Supreme Court. Hi, everybody. This is Jim Mitchell, and I'm pleased, of course, once again to be your host for our conversation as we discuss different factors of the law. And in this month, we're going to take a look at the ruling in Illinois versus Rashid Kassler. Joining me is Lavelle Law defense attorney James Doerr. And, you know, Jim, if I have learned anything from you in our discussions over the last few years, it is that no matter is too small to pursue in seeking justice in the criminal defense system. So I'm looking forward to hear your take on this case. Are we ready to go today?
We are ready. You know, it's interesting that you pointed out and put it that way, Jim. But you know, it's a funny thing in courts of law, you will see every aspect of human life go through the courts of law, so in some way or another. So it's not surprising to me that it's even these kind of facts end up in the Illinois Supreme Court. You know, our own U.S. Supreme Court has had cases that it's shocking that they think that nine justices at that level would consider, you know, the case that's in front of them. But that's the way the law is. And that's, you know, when there's differing opinions in different districts, it ends up going to different, you know, higher courts to resolve those differences. And that's one of the things going on with this case here, is they resolved the discrepancy in some of the lower courts.
Well, let's kind of backtrack. This case comes out of Jackson County in Illinois and originally included three charges against Mr. Kassler. Can you kind of recap for us the specifics of how this case started?
Right. It happened down in Carbondale, and there was three charges presented to a jury in this case, but they only convicted him of one charge. He was charged with possessing cocaine less than 15 grams. He was charged with possessing methamphetamines, I think, less than 5 grams. And then the third charge, the one that made it to the appellate court and then to the Supreme Court, was the one that the jury convicted him on, which was an obstruction of justice charge relating to how he identified himself to one of the police officers on hand.
And this appears to have come out of a kind of a party taking place at a hotel, and police were called, and that's where they discovered the contraband, among other things. But what did the police walk into, and how did this case start to evolve when they arrived on the scene?
Right. Well, it started with – there's actually two police officers here, a sergeant and another patrolman, and they're on foot patrol, and they're going through various hotels through Carbondale, how the case reads. So they find themselves at this Quality Inn at 12:45 a.m., and they're on the second floor, and they're walking down a hallway. And the defendant in this case, they testified that he walked out of the courtroom, walked out of the hotel room, saw the officers, and then went back into the room. The sergeant there said he thought the defendant looked familiar, so that when they came to the door, they were right at the door, they smelled cannabis, close to the officers. So based on the odor of cannabis, or the odor of burnt cannabis, to be specific, they knock on the door. And somebody different, another person than the defendant, a young lady, answers the door. And that's when they realize that they smell an even stronger odor of cannabis. There's a party going on in the hotel room with tequila, a couple guys, a couple women. But our client, or the client in this case, the defendant, he was in the bathroom when the two officers came into the hotel room or opened the door.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So after that, the officer says, you know, because he knew the office, the bathroom door was closed. The officer's still trying to clear the room and trying to account for the person he saw. So he knocks again. He says, anybody in the bathroom, identify yourself. And that's when the sergeant testified. And this is what I love the reading this case here. those of you keeping score at home, we're on page 3. But it says, Sergeant Draper testified that the defendant responded essentially that he was defecating. So we got to close a closed bathroom door,
I could promise you, reading between the lines, that that's not the those aren't the words that the defendant used in this case.
Appropriate for the courtroom, though.
Right. Oh, it all ends up in the court. I mean, seriously. And then, but he did respond to the defendant when he was asked to identify himself. He gave another name. He gave the name of Jakuta King Williams and said he'd had no identification, said he was from Virginia. Patrolman or Sergeant Draper testified that he was initially fooled by this false name. All right. So next step is they run the name. They find out it's not him. There's a little bit of discrepancies between what the patrolman testified, but we'll just keep it kind of simple here that they, you know, they go in the room. When the sergeant has the defendant here leave the bathroom, he immediately recognizes because he had arrested him before. So he knew, he immediately recognized him. He said, "Are you Rashid Kassler?" And the defendant did not respond, so no response, which is a great response. And going back to our earlier podcast, Jim, we know that sometimes no response or remaining silent is the best thing you can do. So that was his best response so far. It's nothing.
So it's interesting now. He the two drug charges, ultimately, he was acquitted of, but he's found guilty obstruction. And Kassler's defense appealed the obstruction charge, first of all, in the appellate court and ultimately the state Supreme Court. And it seems to stem, as you describe, only from the fact that he offered a false name. This, you know, he did not try and flee. He did not try and resist. He just gave a false name. How does that become obstruction?
Right, and they point out further, nothing interfered with Draper's ability to arrest the defendant, and the defendant did not attempt to resist or flee. So it's based only on the providing of a false name, and he was charged because he had an outstanding warrant in his name. So they're saying by responding with a false name, he was trying to resist or obstruct the service of that warrant. But the problem is that the officer knows immediately that this is not Jakuta King Williams. He knows who this defendant is. So he was never material obstructed. So, and really, your question gets to the nuts and bolts of this case and you know, what the prosecutors are charged with or tasked with in proving obstruction charge. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, so the furnishing the false information, they have to also say, and this is part of what the state, the defendant contended, that that the false information materially impeded the administration of justice. So in this case, the administration of justice would be the arrest for the warrant that was out
for the warrant. Yeah.
So, and they're saying did that false information materially impede? And then they get into, this is where the case becomes fun, Jim, is they get into legislative intent. They do some dictionary searches for the words furnish. They even look at one from the dictionary, Webster's dictionary from 1961, when they looked at the statutory language, which is great. On page 6, Jim, when they talk about what courts do consider in ascertaining the full and true intent of a legislature. And there's a nice paragraph there on how judges should properly do this this determination of legislative intent. And they really are not supposed to substitute their own views or fine language is not in statutes. They're supposed to interpret the best they can the language that is presented in the plain language presented.
And that's where, as you said, it got very interesting because, first of all, they dissected very carefully the state statute as it was written, and I want to come back to that statute. But you also alluded, they went to the dictionary, and they pulled out definitions of words, including the word furnish, because that was, did he furnish the information? I guess simple question, have you seen this level of investigation by the court before? I mean, is this a common activity to not only dissect the statute, but to refer to the actual definition of the words?
It happens often enough that I wouldn't call it uncommon. I would say this is a well-drafted opinion, and they really did try to do their best to remain faithful to the legislature's intent. But sometimes it does come down to one word, Jim, and that's kind of what makes the legal business fun. What did the legislature intend when they used that word furnish? And furnish became, they used the word furnish to say that there's an element of material obstruction
in the statute, or imperial impediment in that statute. So that one word became a big turning point in this case.
Well, we're talking with Lavelle Law Attorney James Doerr, taking a look at Illinois versus Kassler, fascinating case in which the defense took its case on a relatively minor obstruction charge all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court. And Jim Doerr is helping us dissect the case and the pursuit of justice as he does every month. You can catch many of our past discussions at lavellelaw.com or iTunes to kind of follow along in some of the different areas that we've covered. But tell us a little bit then about the outcome of this case. Again, convicted and upheld in appellate, but overturned in the Supreme Court. What did the Illinois Supreme Court ultimately decide, and what was their basis for it?
Well, ultimate ruling, they ruled ultimately in the defendant's favor, although they did send it back to the trial court level to resolve the open issue of the charge, because at the trial level, the defense attorney was cut off when he or she was trying to get to that point of when he was cross-examining the officer and others that to the material impediment. They were stopped from going that far. There was an objection by the prosecutor's point, and it was upheld. So at the trial court level, they never got into those exact questions, right? And there's a nice synopsis here, the court record in the opinion here. And you can see it's nice when you can break it down, because you have to create a record for the appellate court, Jim. This is one of the fun things about this case, too. The easier you can make it at the trial court level, even if you're going to lose, you got to create your record for the appellate court to look at and make their ruling.
Yeah, you've mentioned right? that.
So the holding was basically in a prosecution for obstruction of justice by furnishing false information, which is how he was charged. The state must prove that the false information materially impeded the administration of justice. So they reversed the defendant's conviction and they remanded for further proceedings because they're saying that one word or that false identification given to the officer did not materially obstruct in this case, and it based in part because the officer knew who that person was.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I'm going to throw two questions at you if I can get them both in. The first, you talked about the court referring to the state statute, and it seemed that they referred then to the fact that after previous cases, the legislature never changed the statute. So they said, well, if we've used it in other cases, they seem to think it's fine, so they're going to leave it as it is. Again, is that something that we would see come out of the courts, or this edge, or kind of pushing the legislature to update a statute?
Well, it's an example of statutory construction, because each time that the courts interpret a statute, okay, if each time they interpret it, if the legislature doesn't respond by that interpretation, saying they either agree or disagree, or if they disagree, if they don't legislate around that or say that that was not a proper interpretation, then it becomes part of the case law history. It becomes part of statutory history, the interpretations. So legislature has a chance to address any rulings. If they fail to act, then that's ruled as, then they're consenting to this. They know this case law exists. The legislatures are well aware of all these decisions. If they do not act and legislate accordingly, right, then it's noted as well, they must assent to this interpretation because they haven't, legislated otherwise.
And before I let you go, I'm going to refer back to my opening comment and just let you weigh in on it quickly, which is really no matter is too small to pursue when you really feel like you've got a case that you need to prove, and this case is a great example of that.
I agree. This is a fun decision, Jim. I enjoyed this one.
All right. Well, James Doerr, thanks so much for being with us. As always, really enjoyed the conversation, and certainly had a great one to talk about today. Let me again ask people to head over to lavellelaw.com. You can find Mr. Doerr's profile, all of his information on his practice, many years as a criminal defense attorney, as well as past podcasts and articles and videos that he has produced. A lot of great content there for you. So thanks to him. Thanks to everyone for listening. And certainly always look forward to our monthly conversations here on Liberty and the Law.